Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Over 10 years later, the alleged masterminds behind the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others, are finally on trial at the Guantanamo Bay prison. And maybe you heard it got off to a pretty bizarre start. So we'll talk about that and what to expect from the rest of the trial and what we think it should mean with Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
You've been coming on the show to talk about this looming trial for years. Now that it's actually underway, there were some really strange details reported about how it went down at the very beginning. Waleed bin Attash's prosthetic leg brought in after he was brought in restraints. Then he took off his shirt for some reason. KSM came in with a dyed beard. They let them dye their beards in prison at Guantanamo. I didn't know that. The defendants were passing around a copy of The Economist magazine during the proceeding. Muammar Gaddafi's name came up. The defense asked the judge about his religion and what he reads. I mean, kind of ridiculous sounding. Are there no rules in military tribunals?
Well, what's really going on here is a defiant power struggle that is being mounted on the part of the defense. And it seems like it took everybody off guard, beginning with the convening authority and the judge himself. We haven't seen this kind. We've seen them complain over the years. We've seen them mount many defenses on why these trials should not be in the military commissions and how these military commissions are not legitimate. But we've never seen this kind of pushback on every single issue, from the way you walked into and exited the court to the kind of translation that was being presented. And what they're really trying to say is these are not Article III, rather federal courts. And to the extent that they're not Article III courts, they are unfair to the defendants. And this is important because the chief prosecutor, Mark Martins, has made several public statements defending these trials on these commissions, saying that they are essentially going to be as close to Article III courts as possible. And what the defense, the defendants and the defense counsel made very clear in moment after moment of a 13-hour hearing, which was expected to be a couple of hearings, a couple of hours, was that, in fact, these in no way look like Article III courts in substance, in structure, in procedural issues, in administrative issues, in no way.
Article III courts.
Article III courts are the federal courts that try federal criminal cases, such as the terrorism cases we've seen tried here. Most recently, the Guantanamo detainee, Gailani.
So people on both sides of the military versus civilian trial debate reacted to the arraignment in different ways, because they said either, see what a disaster the military court is. This should have happened in a federal court. No wonder they're drawing attention to it at every turn in the way you were just describing. The other side says, see what a disaster this is. Imagine how much worse it would have been in a civilian court with all its additional looseness compared to a military tribunal. Do they not have a point?
You know, it's hard to say that they have a point, because the problem with military commissions, and this will remain the problem throughout, I don't see a way around it, is that they don't exist. We don't have a system of military commissions. We're trying this from, you know, the beginning for the most important trials we've had since 9/11 and the most important ones we will have. So we don't know how the procedures play out. We don't know what the rules are. And so to say that the federal courts would be less good at it, it's just a debating point.
Listeners, what do you think about how the way this trial has started? 212-433-WNYC. Or what do you want to ask about it of Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's go right to a call. Here's Alex in Jamaica. Alex, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call. I think that your guest is being a little bit generous to the defense in terms of their goals. I don't think that they're over here protesting that this is an Article 3, you know, not or an Article 3 court. I think if this were an Article 3 court, they'd be doing the exact same things. They know that they're never going to be outside of detention by the United States. They know, many of them, they're probably going to die by the hand of the United States. And as such, they simply want to make the most ridiculous show trial kind of spectacle that they can achieve. And if we were to give them an Article 3 trial, I don't think that they'll have something, oh, no, wait, we're good now. We understand. Let's follow procedure. They'd be doing the exact same things. Maybe the lawyers wouldn't be quite so, complicit, but definitely the defense would, the individuals themselves.
Karen Greenberg, why not? Aren't they out to demonstrate the illegitimacy of the United States and United States foreign policy in a much broader way from their perspective than just Gitmo versus civilian court?
I think it's a valid question, and there's some merit to it. However, these are defense attorneys who have tried for 10 years to try and get their defendants, their clients, charged. And so the fact is they want them charged, and that's all this particular hearing was. The other thing is that a vast amount of time in this 13-hour hearing was about voir dire for the judge. We don't have that in a civilian court. Therefore, you can't really say that this same thing would have happened, because pushback on a judge is just inconceivable. To question the qualifications of a judge, to talk about what he read or what his politics are, we accept our judges as the top authority in our courts. Here you have a situation where the judge, Judge Paul, a number of times pointed to the fact that, well, he couldn't be asked about that because he actually wasn't in charge on some things. The convening authority was. So I think while the point is well taken and something worth thinking about, in this particular hearing, I actually don't think it was relevant.
The arraignment lasted over 13 hours, and they didn't even enter their pleas. The defendants deferred until the next hearing, which is scheduled for June 12th. Are we going to see the same kind of spectacle?
Well, I think that the military commissions are on warning. That's what this was. And I think they will do a great deal to try to make sure that that doesn't happen. But now we get what the general tactic of pushback and defiance is. One thing that you don't usually see in a civilian court is the intense antagonism between the defense and the prosecution and the defense and the judge. I mean, the whole point of these trials, we just had a trial in the Eastern District of New York, a very high-profile terrorism case about from people who wanted to blow up the New York City subway. In that case, it was remarkable how well the defense and the prosecution got along and how they shared information and thought about which documents should be presented and which material should be presented. So you need some kind of base agreement among the lead players, and that's what we didn't have.
The way this is being observed by journalists and victims' families and others is interesting. They can watch the hearing through glass at Guantanamo, and there's a closed-circuit feed coming to places outside of Guantanamo, but the government has insisted on a 40-second delay. The censors can switch off the sound if something happens that they don't want the public to hear, and the censors apparently did cut off the feed after defense lawyers uttered the word torture for the first time, though they then turned it back on. So how is that judgment made from your understanding, and what is the government afraid of, and what can we expect not to be allowed to know about this trial based on what we saw on day one?
You know, this is a very good point that you raise. I believe on that particular white noise issue, they said that they didn't mean to have it cut off or something like that. But in general, one of the big questions hanging over this military commission's trial is, to what extent will torture appear? And to what extent will the appearance of torture delay the trial, have foul play called? Mark Martins, the chief prosecutor, has gone way out of his way to say that he will not have tortured evidence presented, and he is not trying to hide the government in terms of embarrassment or illegalities. On the other hand, no one really believes that the torture, to the extent that the defense seems to want to present it and to which they think it's relevant, will be allowed. And the other day it was brought up in terms of the defendants not wearing their headphones on the grounds that the torture that they had suffered had actually made it impossible for them to wear this headgear. Now, whether or not that's just a point of pushback or whether that's valid, we don't know. But if it's coming up this early in that kind of sort of logistical situation, can you imagine how it will come up in the later parts of the trial where it's actually relevant to the crime itself?
And how do you think they would bring up the question of torture? I want to read you a passage from the New York Post on Sunday from an article called How We Broke KSM, CIA Big Spills on Terrorist Rude Awakening, 180 Hours of No Sleep. And it's kind of a blow-by-blow, and who knows how accurate it is, but it's one version of a blow-by-blow of how they interrogated Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and what techniques they used. And there are a lot of things in here, in addition to waterboarding, that people are probably not familiar with, so I'm going to read a little of this. It said he, quote, was subjected to a range of methods. They may have included dietary restrictions, where prisoners wore diapers and were fed only the dietary shake and sure, leaving detainees naked in their cells was also used. And then there was walling, it says, in which interrogators pushed him backwards in a small plywood-walled room so that his shoulder blades bounced off the wall with a boom. We were after shock value, says the interrogator Rodriguez. Other corrective techniques, quote-unquote, included the attention grasp, where a detainee is grabbed on both sides of the collar and yanked toward the interrogator. The facial hold, where an interrogator places a hand on each side of the detainee's face and holds it immobile. And the insult slap, where the person is slapped between the chin and the bottom of his earlobe. And it quotes this agent as saying, more than one detainee expressed surprise when slapped and told the interrogator, hey, you aren't supposed to do that. The Al-Qaeda training manual told them that Americans would treat them with kid gloves. But what really broke KSM apparently was sleep deprivation. He finally broke because he couldn't just stay awake and stay awake and stay awake. Are all of those things techniques that you've heard of? And how many of those do you think would be introduced as alleged torture?
I think nearly all of them will be introduced as alleged torture, because the idea of physical abuse of any sort to elicit information is torture. And let me tell you where all of these techniques were specified in very gritty detail in an Office of Legal Counsel memo that was released by the Obama administration in its early days. So these are not new tech. They were new to the American public in the early days of the Obama administration, but now we've come to know them, and they were considered legal. So this is where, of course, the problem begins. The real question on when you break and how you break has to be premised upon a first question, which is, could you have gotten the information otherwise? Very interesting that Judge Pohl raised the fact that he had read The Black Banners, a book by Ali Soufan, who is the FBI interrogator, who interrogated not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but Abu Zubaydah, and said he got much of the information and would have gotten more without the waterboarding, without the torture. So the real question of torture is not, you know, what breaks them and how does it break them, but could you have gotten it by more legitimate, more recognizably legal techniques.
And on the waterboarding, by the way, at least according to this account in the Post, it says Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was one of only three prisoners waterboarded by the United States, but Mohammed knew his interrogators would never kill him, so he coolly remained impassive as he was waterboarded 183 times, according to the agent. Quote, he seemed to have figured out that we weren't going to push things too far.
Yes, and in contrast to Abu Zubaydah, who did not apparently have that, Abu Zubaydah allegedly released a number of very important names, which Khalid Sheikh Mohammed never did. The reason this is important is that defense attorneys can claim that any other, and probably will claim, that any other confessions that were made in more peaceable circumstances, not under tortured circumstances, still bear the marks of that original torture. And so, therefore, much of what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said during his combatant status review tribunals at Guantanamo will be pulled into question when they're brought into court.
Would you call sleep deprivation torture if it went on for 180 hours? Because they say in this article that that's what broke him. That was the one thing that he couldn't stand.
Absolutely. The goal of these things was to break the individual, to break down the individual human being. And if that was the goal, then sleep deprivation works tremendously well. And that's what we know, that not just from torture.
I think... I thought we had a caller who was going to push. Yes, Ron in Summers, I think, will push back on that idea. Ron, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, how are you today? I find it interesting that the young lady has decided to put the court proceedings on trial and not the individuals that were there. Is she also aware that the female defense attorney requested that the females wear burqas in the courtroom? That's kind of interesting you omitted that information.
Ron, thank you. Well, certainly it's one of – and I'll take responsibility for talking about how the trial is being conducted, because that's one of the roles of journalism, is to monitor the justice system. Obviously, we think these are the worst kind of mass murderers imaginable, and we'll follow the trial in terms of what they did as well, and we've been talking about that for 10 years since 9/11, but this is – a trial that's just begun under very controversial circumstances. What about that particular stunt? And it was a stunt, wasn't it, by the female defense attorney who's not Muslim, wearing a burqa and asking that everybody else who's there, including all the other females who are there, including American military women who were dressed in military uniforms that included skirts, that they dress more conservatively so that the Muslim defendants won't have to look at them and potentially commit a sin?
Yeah, I think there are different takes on different parts of this. First, let me say that what most of us want is for this trial to have happened a long time ago. It's not about taking the side of the defendants in terms of not having a trial or not thinking that they're guilty. But in this particular case of the lawyer who dressed up in an abaya and covered herself except for her face, I think to the extent that she was trying to be part of the defense statement of that day, which we're going to push back, we don't recognize these proceedings, you're not recognizing our legal rights as defense attorneys or our defendants' rights, it was effective, and we're going to remember it forever. In terms of actually saying that the court and the other attorneys should be dressed that way, look, this is an American court of law, whether it's a civilian court or a military court. And to that extent, it seems to me that we're fighting for our rule of law, and that's what we should maintain in every way, including dress.
We're just about out of time. When does the actual trial portion of this trial start to take place, where evidence is heard with respect to the defendants?
It looks like it's going to be a year from now. I think at the
a
very
year
end,
from
I,
now.
I think it's going to be a year from
What's
now.
What's going to take a year?
I think the discovery, the defense reading through the documents, having enough resources to get them translated, and getting ready to feel like they can actually mount the defense that they need to defend, they need to use.
We have 30 seconds left, but what have they been doing for the past 10 years, if not discovery?
Well, yes, but they also have to see what the government has against them, and I think they haven't seen a lot of that until now, and I think that's a very good question. And listen, if this trial could happen tomorrow, nothing could make me happier.
Much talk about Guantanamo yet to come. I guess the president won't close it before re-election or before this trial could conclude.
I would say that is a very safe bet.
Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the politics of President Obama coming out for legal gay marriage yesterday. Stay with us.